Okay, good morning. I'm going to go ahead and call this meeting to order, and if we can have roll call, please.
Sue.
Present.
Nate.
Present.
Chad.
Where's Chad's online?
Carrie.
Present.
Leslie. Alda. Jamie's
online, I think.
Jesse. Wendy. Chris. Jane.
Here.
Matthew.
Here.
Susie.
Here.
Stacy. Randy. Katie.
Here.
Jessica Armstrong.
Present.
Emily.
Present.
Kara.
Here.
Dean. Jessica Allard.
Present.
Kim.
Here.
Brad.
Brad should be on.
Thanks, Brad. Lena. Janelle?
Here.
Andrew Gray for Amanda Wall?
I am here online. It's really hard to hear, though.
Okay, I'll try to fix that in a second. Thanks. Melissa Parks?
Present.
Trish? Trish is online. Connie is online. Samara, I have Mary Buchanan for Samara Tabor.
Here.
Anybody whose name I did not call? Quorum was met.
Thank you. Do I have a motion to approve today's agenda?
I'll move.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Thank you. Any edits or additions?
There was one addition online, I think. She just wanted to do an update. It was
Leslie wanted to update the employee engagement subcommittee meeting.
Okay. I think we can do that during committee reports. All right. Anything else? Yeah, she has to have supervisor approval before she's formal. So once we get that squared away, she'll formally be a rep. Thank you. Great. Okay, any other edits to the agenda today? Okay. Any opposition to passing the agenda? Great. Hearing none, we have an agenda. We have time for a, oh great, thanks guys. Time for a Green Dot Minute if anyone has anything they'd like to share on that topic. Just keep your eyes out. I know they're working on getting more training opportunities and train the trainer opportunities out there. So if that's something you're interested in, just keep an eye out. It would be a great opportunity to get engaged. All right. So we have no current pending actions. So with that, I'll just move right along. And we have Brad Loveland and Margot Griffith here from UAS Human Resources to talk about the new University of Alaska Employee Performance Evaluation Form that is in draft. And I believe that was attached or sent out also this morning. So for those of you who aren't here, you should have gotten it emailed as well from Nicole. And it looks like we have that also as a separate handout in the room.
Stuff out in more detail, but I think these competencies the whole deal. When we're doing that, when we're performing at that function. So quality, quantity, initiative, collaboration, communication. The last one is for supervisors. If you're supervising people who also manage, that is one of the topics. Then there's a comment section. So we're not going to have everything that we need a comment, but an overall comment section. So if you have anything that they would like to talk about. We want to try to limit what people say to us, not have just a long plethora of making things, because when you make people write comments, sometimes they push themselves or I think they either don't mean or they can't express correctly. And so we really want to get this focus.
Sorry. I think everybody in the room can hear you fine, but some of the people say online that if you just keep close to the mic.
Okay. So, that's okay. So we go through the competencies and the next section is the comments. Then the next section is goals, where you can align some smart goals, and hopefully it will be trackable so you can pull from the next Alaska goals from the last performance appraisal. So it's going to be really up to date. The next section is training or action plans. So this is where if you have any improvement in your competencies area, this is where you put an action plan down. An action plan is basically here's the issue, here's how I'm going to measure it, here's how I'm going to measure it. And in the guidance document, it walks through each one of these sections and gives you a little bit more information on that. The last section is kind of training and development. And this is where we'll have the learning training assign trainings to them, so if they need supervisory training, they can show up. We have also developed a PowerPoint training, so the PowerPoint training is going to talk in the first session about how to do performance evaluations, what they are for, how to do them, tips and tricks for completing them. Second section is actually about page up and walking through the system. We didn't want to do that today because it's iterative. Once we get closer to the rollout date, and we are pushing November 1st to roll out, please don't put that in the cornerstone yet. Four other entities that have, or three other entities that have to agree. They're really trying to get November 1st as the date. Employees are hungry for feedback that's constructive and positive. Supervisors focus on that and also help employees track their performance as well. So we're really excited about it.
Yeah, I think this is really going to force folks to have more communication because within the system, there's a life cycle of the evaluation process. And it specifically calls out certain actions like conversation with your employee, sitting down and setting expectations. And those are a lot of the things that folks feel like they're missing, that one-on-one feedback and guidance from their supervisors. So I think this is really going to help folks through that process and provide that information that folks really need to be successful.
Margo, will it remind the supervisors when those are due?
Yes, it will. And it really does keep a good timeline for folks, and it also helps leadership hold supervisors accountable for making sure that they do complete their evaluations and have those conversations with folks. It also enables supervisors to provide training, which this is going to be a two-way conversation. We don't want this to be completely automated, but there is an automated process to this so that we can track that. And so that there's clear communication. So say you as an employee want to go through a certain training, you can actually put that within this evaluation as well, because not only is the supervisor writing it, but the employee is engaged in completing this as well and giving feedback and having some control over their professional development. But one other thing I wanted to mention too, a lot of folks want to be able to provide feedback on their supervisors. The system will also give that opportunity. So if I was evaluating Brad and I wanted feedback from his subordinate, there's a process that the evaluator can send out an email to his subordinates and get feedback on his performance as well. So there's a lot to this system. Just like with the recruitment system, there's going to be little things that we'll learn along the way, but there are a lot of great opportunities with implementing this.
Relating to like a supervisor sort of evaluation, many supervisors choose to do like a self-evaluation as part of this. Does the system provide for that at all?
Yeah, it absolutely does. That is part of that interactive process.
So there's two things that, in particular, that I think are really, really positive about this. Especially looking back at the results of the training and employee development survey that was rolled out. One of those was the ability to hold people accountable because it's so trackable and you can easily see, hey, does the supervisor who works for me do their job? And leadership can easily see that and hold people accountable. And then the second piece is, you know, I think the biggest feedback through that survey on why performance evaluations weren't happening was that it took too much time. And I think a lot of that time, too, for people was like copying and pasting in each piece of the performance or the job description and trying to get all that in. So I think that those two kind of trends in general are really positive here for getting these things to actually be used and be done. So thank you, guys. I know you've put a ton of work into this.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make on these evaluations. Once you establish the information in the evaluation, it'll carry throughout the life cycle of someone's employment within that position. So if, say it was a 6-month evaluation after you start a new position, you set some goals, those goals will carry over to the annual evaluation so that there's feedback and consistency throughout that individual's employment.
Any other questions? How about online?
So is this going to be a mandatory form for all of UA, or is this going to be like previous rollouts you have 3 or 4 evaluations for the last 4 or 5 years to where it was optional?
Brad, can I just emphasize or reiterate? I think you mentioned the short timeline this is on. If we have feedback, I think you mentioned last week that we're trying to coordinate that by the end of this week, by Friday. Okay.
Brad, do you want the feedback to just come from a consolidated staff council response? Okay, so I'd say Trish and anyone else with feedback, just go ahead and send that to me and Nate, and then we'll put together a staff council response sort of in one document and get that to HR so that they're not having to compile a lot. So, yeah.
If that's all the questions about the feedback form, I will also bring up one more thing since we have Margo and Brad here, and this is something that came up at staff lines last week, and I know it's covered elsewhere on the agenda, but regarding university furlough policy, we have been notified at the alliance level of furloughs that have been approved at UAF. Currently, UAF, I think, is the only campus that has experienced furloughs, but there has also been some questions and a little bit of confusion about the process of annual leave accrual, and there's been a little bit of, I think, discrepant information. So while we have Margo and Brad here, I might just invite either one of them to respond to the questions about true-up processes. And
yeah, thank you for the question. So with the way furloughs are handled, and this is specifically for hourly or non-exempt employees, this doesn't pertain to exempt or salaried employees, but with the hourly folks, the way the furlough process works is those individuals have to actually claim a leave code. If you are claiming that leave code, which is essentially like leave without pay, you don't accrue leave on that code within Banner. So not only is it annually, it's also sick leave. When those particular circumstances arise, payroll has to manually go in and front load the leave bucket so that folks still receive their full accrual. If that's part of the furlough component, is folks don't lose their benefits. They still have full benefits. So on October 7th, payroll did go in and front load all the leave buckets for folks that are on furlough, and there are, I believe, about 24 people that are in that situation. So they do have contract letters that specifically state those details. They can go in and check their leave balances, and if there are questions, they're welcome to give us a call, and we can walk through that with them and how that can work.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for coming here today, and we will collect any feedback and get it back to you on the form there. And thank you again for taking the time.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have anyone for public comment today? Okay, anyone online for public comment? Okay, hearing none, we'll go into officers' reports. I don't have a ton to report. I'll let Nate take the Staff Alliance piece now. I want to say we did start with the Strategic Pathways teams last week. And I know we have a couple UAS staff members. I'm on the Institutional Research team, and Wendy Roop, who represents SFOS for UAS Staff Council, is on the Fisheries Program Review team on the academic side. And I haven't heard from Wendy yet, but I'll say certainly the team I was on this time, the process for the first meeting was really positive. The tone was really positive and cooperative among the different institutional research groups in the room. And I think the process feels already a little smoother than the first round. I think they are sort of kind of learning and working out kinks on this as they go. And then I know they've also formed some implementation or beginning kind of implementation teams for the phase one strategic pathways bits, so that they'll have a little more to report to the board at the next Board of Regents meeting. Things where, for example, the School of Education or the Education Phase 1 team, their recommendation was to have one School of Education total with one dean total. That's a very simple statement that could contain 8,000 different variations on how you get there. So that's, they're starting to work through kind of that next phase now of how do we get to this recommendation and how do we put these things in place and what does it really look like. So I'm expecting that we'll see some updates on that within the next month or so. And certainly in advance of the next board meeting, I would expect some opportunity there. And then the next board meeting will be the budget approval meeting. So that's for the FY18 budget request. So the process for that, just as a kind of brief overview, is at UAF we work internally to say what we'd like in the next year's budget, what we'd like to see. Then that goes to statewide. Basically, all the chancellors, the summit team meets, discusses that, kind of unifies a University of Alaska request with the administration. The Board of Regents approves that or modifies that, and then that goes to the governor. And then the governor will adjust that up or down. And then the governor's budget goes to the legislature in the spring. And then the legislature, as we all know, can take several months with many iterations. And then we find out, hopefully before July 1st, so far we've managed to squeak through, what our actual budget for next fiscal year will be. So I think we've asked that at our next meeting, Office of Management and Budget comes and gives sort of a budget overview and budget process overview. We've done that in the past with sort of some handouts on the process and also talking through what UAF's budget priorities are for the next year. But just knowing that our next Board of Regents meeting is coming up in a month, and that'll be kind of on the discussion there. I just wanted to give a heads up. I think that, am I missing anything obvious? Do you know? Okay. All right. So with that, I'll hand it off to Nate.
Sure. Thanks, Faye. Yeah, so I will cover a few alliance things here. As Faye mentioned, I was in Juneau in September for the Regents meeting. It's been widely covered, so I won't go over every direction for the Phase 1 Pathways teams, but I would invite people to review the directions that the President has recommended for each of the eight Pathways teams from Phase 1. I will also observe that there's I don't think it's entirely clear definitions for what direction means, and I think that the word decisions was also used in the President's email, which is slightly discrepant from the way that the information was rolled out to the regions. It's also unclear exactly what the process, pathway that process will take between now and the November Regents meeting. I would observe just from some other conversations that I've had that there's already been some individual Regents members who have sought out processes and information from departments and schools across the system since that Regents meeting. So what the President recommended for directions and what the Board approved for directions for him to pursue, it's not guaranteed that process will be a simple one between now and November. So I guess I would just encourage folks to continue to pay attention at your unit level to any kind of changes or adjustments to those directions between now and final approvals of plans for Phase 1 before the next Regents meeting. I'll also say that we covered at our Alliance meeting last week, we covered a number of important issues, including furloughs. Tara Ferguson, the statewide HR director, and Brad were both there to discuss evaluation and discuss furlough policy and to kind of clear up some of these issues. So that was helpful and positive. And I would thank Brad again. I know that he spends a lot of time and energy on communicating with staff people, and I think he understands the power of communicating any changes or process adjustments to staff in particular. So I think that that's all good. Let's see, what else?
I'll just chime in on that. I know I think with statewide HR in general thought, okay, we've gone to Staff Alliance. We've taken it to governance, and Brad said, no, I need to talk to Staff Council too. I want to make sure that people have a chance to ask directly at the Staff Council bit. So,
and it takes feedback very seriously, I think. So I would encourage people to think very seriously about these new evaluation kind of processes and to consider feedback, because I think that's how these things get better and more useful. So So UAA conducted their own, at their staff council level, they conducted their own morale survey in some ways very similar to the engagement survey that was rolled out here last year. And they got results that were somewhat similar, which, you know, are basically that morale is low, that people are looking for jobs elsewhere because they're unsure about their own positions and the future of their programs and departments. So I think that spurred the folks at Southeast to also consider conducting a survey at the staff council level there. I think that they will use the UAA model for that survey to roll out their own survey. And once they have results, we're exploring an effort at the alliance level to consolidate the results of all three MAU surveys regarding morale and to deliver those through alliance and to highlight those results at a system-wide level because I think that can have some important impacts. And that's all I got.
Thanks. Okay. Any questions for either for me or for Nate? All right. So moving on to governance reports, I see we have Colby from ASUAF. Come on up. Wherever you want to be. Yeah.
Good morning again, everyone. It's a pleasure to come and speak to you again for the second time this semester. I will keep my comments brief, but I'll be happy to take any questions if you have any. Right. Our focus largely has been on getting feedback to the Board of Regents about the second phase of strategic, or about the first phase, excuse me, of strategic pathways on the various options presented to them, and then in addition to the 10% increase in tuition that President Johnson proposed. We do realize that the feedback process is kind of in its final stages now, so we're making sure that everyone has an opportunity to get their last-minute feedback in. We have, UAF has several students serving on Phase 2 teams. I haven't had a chance to touch base with them. I've been in a conference this weekend. They just took the red eye in this morning, actually. I'm interested to see their perceptions on the phase two process. They're brand new to strategic pathways, all of the members that are serving on those teams. So, I am interested to see what their take is on the process. On the 13th of October, that's this Thursday, I believe, at 6 p.m. in Scheibel Auditorium, we'll be holding a debate between Senate candidates Coghill and Hopkins. We are informed by General Counsel that staff can't participate in any way, but it is open to the public. So you are welcome to join and observe. And that's all that I could come up with on my red eye flight. But I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. 6 p.m. Scheibel Auditorium.
Colby, did the direction you got from council on that, was that like in the form of an email or anything that you could send along just so that we know if we show up how, how
that came from Vice Chancellor Burrell's office. So okay. I would recommend contacting either your unit's Vice Chancellor or Vice Chancellor Burrell.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions for Colby? All right. Thank you, Colby.
Thank you.
Get some rest. Okay. And now we have Chris Fallon from the Faculty Senate.
Good morning. So I guess we have our Senate meeting today, and one of our top priorities in Senate is basically revising our so-called Blue Book, which defines things like promotion and evaluation criteria.
Chris, sorry, could you speak right into the mic? We're just having trouble with people online here.
So we're looking at the Blue Book, which defines our promotion and evaluation criteria, and in a lot of ways that's supposed to be in sync with our collective bargaining agreement with UNAC, and it's so far out of date, and now we're it's time to renegotiate our collective bargaining agreement. In fact, one of the negotiation sessions is today, and you know, I know that staff are not represented by unions, but these negotiation sessions are open, and if you do have the time, I would recommend at least sitting in on it to see kind of what the process is like, and to see how, say, the union, you know, actually has to make the case of the value of faculty to a university, and through this process, you know, if there are additional attempts to unionize staff, you know, it just helps them inform a decision about whether that's right or not for for staff here. And so that's been a kind of an interesting process, in particular in working with UNAC, where we had to, as research faculty and cooperative extension faculty that are largely externally funded, we had to justify our value to UNAC as, I guess, what we'd call revenue positive faculty. So also strategic pathways, you know, I just mentioned that we're in the process of round two of strategic pathways, and this time I'm on the health committee, which is largely a UAA issue, and it's on the academic side. And one of the changes I've noticed with this round, at least with my committee and some of the others that I've heard from, is that our charge for our team or committee is it no longer includes this consolidate everything at one university and cut costs by 20%. We're now allowed to consider growing revenue and building programs, which I think is quite a positive development, and it seemed to lead to a more of a constructive meeting. It also was really interesting because there are, you know, various groups represented on these teams, faculty, perhaps staff, community members, and this time we had a community member who I think shares a lot of misconceptions about the university that are often held even by many of our own regents about that may come from a business or corporate background that don't see why the university cannot just implement changes virtually immediately or within a week, things like common calendar or consolidate procurement and travel all into one office. And at the same time, why can't we create new programs at the same time, you know, just basically instantly? And I don't think there's a recognition in how labor-intensive what we all do here. I mean, for example, and I tried to, you know, provide some examples of when we went to our new annual activity reports, because there's a lot of back-end work in translating or compiling stuff from the Word documents that we as faculty filled in, describing all of our activities. Well, now that's all, we enter that data ourselves into some sort of portal, similar to the travel management system. Now we have to enter all that in. And basically we've taken a process that was handled, I think, very efficiently by staff that were very good at working through the system and did it, you know, without very many mistakes. And we've pushed a lot of this work now onto faculty. And on paper, that looks like savings. But in actuality, now, you know, the annual activity report now takes me a day and a half when it took me half a day before. So that's a day that I'm not writing proposals or writing papers or doing lesson plans or interacting with students. And so my point in all this is that, you know, I don't have a specific suggestion, but any ways that we can communicate the value of what we do, you know, as faculty, as staff, to the broader community, I think would be helpful, because I think a lot of the criticism that we're under to consolidate and reduce costs, and sure there are areas we can do that, a lot of it is fueled by some misconceptions about how a university actually works. Other things going on that aren't in the Senate agenda, we had a invitation to the state legislature on Westridge that we were able to show off some of our research and how research has a net benefit to the state, both in terms of the problems and issues that we're tackling, but also because we're bringing in money from federal sources. And again, for every dollar, say, that I spend on my own salary or on a student's salary or on a piece of equipment, another 50 cents goes to the university and keeps the lights on and pays for staff as well. And so I think that was a positive thing. Whenever we have an opportunity to communicate with regents or with the legislature or even the general public, is I think a positive is a positive thing. So I'll leave it at that.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for Chris on Faculty Summit activities? Great. Thank you for joining us. All right. Moving to unfinished business. At our last meeting, we discussed the Carolyn Sampson Memorial Scholarship, the requested criteria changes. So thank you guys for the really good questions. I took those back to the UA Foundation. The main crux was looking at that last qualification that previously said preference will be given to a single female or male student who is the single head of household. And the sort of initial request from the foundation was remove single because we can't discriminate based on marital status. And then there was a lot of discussion about within staff council about, well, if you're filing head of household for tax reasons, that's by default, you have to be single to do that, so that head of household is in fact also discriminatory potentially by those standards. And we'd also, I think, heard a bit from the Title IX group that day as well on gender identity and how we also potentially have a lot of students who are gender nonconforming. So saying a male or female student is potentially unnecessary as well. So I took that back to foundation with the question of if we're striking single, was the intent that we just strike the word single or that we just strike that last qualification piece altogether from the criteria? And he was very grateful for our thorough reading of the issue and said, yes, striking the final criteria there altogether would be the best approach. So this is, by the way, the first attachment to the agenda. So there is a draft motion attached today to change that, change the qualifications, removing the final piece. And so I guess if a motion is attached, it's on. No, it's going to come to the committee. Right. Okay. Not inherently. I think we're safe on that. Okay. So if I can have a motion, and then we can have discussion.
Do you need a motion to attach or a motion to?
I guess I need a motion to amend the Carolyn Sampson. Da 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 da.
I move that we amend the scholarship.
Thank you. Do you have a second?
I second.
Thank you. Okay, so now I'll open it for discussion.
I understand that we have to follow legal counsel on this subject and that obviously we have to meet our Title IX requirements. And I feel like the spirit of this scholarship was to support people who met these criteria. And I don't know that there's a way for us to do that without discriminating against those who don't meet the criteria.
So my understanding of it is, there's still the write-up a bit about here's who Carolyn Sampson was and why this was established. And So these are sort of the minimum qualifications to be considered for the scholarship. I think people could say, oh, this student is really in the spirit of Carolyn Sampson as well, but we were ruling, with this qualification, we were ruling people out because of their marital status, which could potentially also have led to students who weren't necessarily in the, I think it's probably unfair to say that the defining feature of Carolyn Sampson as a human being was that she was married or not married. It was that she was reentering the job market, that was, kind of her intent was this retraining for people who were supporting families as well. And I think we also could have potentially students who are not yet divorced, but who have been single parenting for 10 years as well. So I think there's a lot of ways that just the legal marital status isn't necessarily the best way to measure whether but I definitely take that comment. That was my initial concern as well, was these were the criteria that were sort of set out at the time it was established to sort of best capture that spirit. But I do think certainly the message I received was this has to change either way. It's a lot easier to change it if we do it this way.
Right. So Trish has raised an interesting point. She pointed to a .gov website that lists a series of scholarships and financial aid available to what seem to be groups, including single mothers and heads of household that are protected class issues. I wonder if does the foundation or do you have an understanding of?
So my understanding is the foundation is referring to actually specific UAF Regents policy that says we will not discriminate based on protected class for our scholarships, and marital status specifically is a protected class.
Yeah.
So this is a Board of Regents direction that was use protected class as a criteria, and this specifically is.
Quick perusal of these groups seem to be that many of them or all of them are independent organizations that may not have the same policies, although there are a couple universities listed.
Hmm. Yeah, so I think it is a UA policy specifically that they're attempting to comply with, which is based on protected class.
Yeah, I would observe that everybody that I've had a conversation with this about has kind of come to a similar conclusion that this is extremely annoying that we have to do this, and it seems to conflict with the original intent of the scholarship itself, but the policy represents a significant barrier.
I agree with that. I think that the good intent is being squished by the policy, and you could argue that any of these scholarships, like you were saying, just about any scholarship for minorities or anything like that is violating something. It's getting to where I feel like it's almost impossible to have good intent and help a certain group and target the person, the kind of person that you want to help out, and the people that. I think maybe that would force me to try and have more discussion with the people making the policy to have some kind of exceptions for that sort of thing. I wouldn't roll over that easy and say, oh, we can't do it because of that. Until I got a no that said we can't do it. Absolutely not. We won't change our policy or make any exceptions.
Okay.
Yeah, Leslie, go ahead.
I think you'd have to define what non-traditional student meant, and it could be discriminatory if your basis is age, which is a typical basis for non-traditional.
Mm-hmm. I think what Faye brought up is a good point, though.
That's what they're Brad, they're going through all the scholarships that have any restrictions based on protected class, which would include age, and flagging them for changes. And in each case, they're going back to either the original donor or administrator, which for this specific one is staff council, and working with them to get changes made.
So with that, I would just say be prepared for an increase in applications and a lot extra time for that. I know University Women's Association faced the same thing a couple years ago. We had to take female out and some other criteria, and so we had a lot more to sort through because it was much easier for students to apply.
I can say that I see a lot of this happening from the UA Foundation. We get the email notifications at the Office of Grants and Contracts showing, so it's not just ours. They're going through all of them, and I've had a lot of them that I would like, the same thing I'm looking at, I'm like, that kind of seems like it's taking away to the intent of the original award. So it is, they're looking at all of them and doing this to all of them that kind of are discriminatory, so.
Katie, did you have something you were trying to say earlier?
Well, I was going to say, it just comes down to, like you said, the spirit of why they're awarding this, and it's up to the committee to, yes, read through everything, but making sure that the person that created that award, that they're being represented in it correctly, or how they would want it to have been awarded. Mm-hmm. So I guess if it endangers the ability to give out that award, I see it as kind of being a moot point.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, did you have a hand up? Okay.
I feel like at the last meeting I asked who read for this award, and I can't remember the answer.
Who read for it?
Like who does the reading for?
Who makes the selection?
Yeah. What organization manages the committee to read this?
We do.
We do.
Yeah. We have a committee each spring, summer. That goes through and selects the winner, which is why basically this is now our issue to deal with.
To some extent, that makes me feel better.
Yeah.
You know.
I'd also say though to Aldo's point that there's an initial round of screening where demographic information that applies to specific scholarships allow the financial aid office to filter applicants, and the fewer filters there are on applicants, the more work energy will be required on the part of our own committee here, the more applications they'll see.
And Trish, I see your question. It wasn't, I'm sorry if there was miscommunication, there wouldn't be new wording in the documentation, but if you go to page 9 of the agenda, there is the purpose of the program. There's a very brief description of Carolyn Sampson, and then it says, the intent of this award is to provide new career paths or retraining to applicants wishing to re-enter the job market or whose work activity may be threatened by economic, health, or other factors. And so that is sort of the key purpose of the award here. And then there's sort of the additional governing of it and how funding is determined, et cetera. And then if it should become apparent that the purpose described herein is no longer feasible, either because there's not suitable recipients or because there's changing concerns of education or society, then the income for the support of this fund shall be used in support of a program that reflects the original intent of the fund, shall be determined by the chancellor advising the staff council prior to making a decision. So if we think that the purpose isn't appropriate at this point, then we basically end the scholarship. We don't come up with a new purpose, basically. And then there are the full the full other qualifications other than being single. I mean, I do think I share the concerns overall that not awarding these based on protected class is really antithetical to a lot of the intents, which was to specifically provide support to groups that traditionally had less support. Nate and I, in the pre-staff prior to last meeting, expressed those concerns to the chancellor and to Kari Burrell, saying that, you know, it did seem that as a trend, this was concerning potentially, and that we weren't sure it was, the best direction. I guess personally, at this point, I'm not sure that whether or not the Regents and the foundation have this policy of not discriminating based on protected class is truly a staff council issue and the best use of staff council energies. I guess my preference would be not to take that on as a full issue, but that's just my preference. And if the will of the group is to work otherwise, then I'm okay with that. But it seems that this is a very small part of what we are responsible for.
I wonder, I guess, personally, if there are any other groups that are going through the same process, since the foundation is doing this on a widespread basis, that have similar concerns to ours. Do you know?
I think less so within the university, because a lot of them, well, perhaps with the Women's Center, you could...
Women's Association.
Women's Association.
Yeah, it's actually technically a student group, but it's run by community volunteers. Mm-hmm. It's the original purpose was back when things were definitely very different. The wives of faculty needed, a group to help them orient to new life in Alaska. I mean, this was started, in the 50s. And since then, it's evolved. I mean, membership is open to men. We've given a scholarship last year to male students. But our screening question is now, do you agree with our mission statement, basically, which is about supporting the university in pursuit of academic excellence, et cetera. So I'm wondering if you want to kind of make sure that people are playing in the spirit of it, can you have a screening question that says something about re-entering the workforce? Is that potentially problematic? Or would that be something that would at least, because we're talking from like 30 applications to 130 applications. So to maybe reduce that, if people are self-selecting, a screening question might be worth a little bit of time.
And that is actually the penultimate qualification right before that, saying that preference would be given to a single student. It is what would be our new last qualification, basically, is that in accordance with the original intent of the fund, recipients of this award should be seeking new career paths or retraining to re-enter the
program. Yeah, I think that would be helpful.
Implementation.
Okay.
Or that.
Yeah, sorry, Leslie, you were breaking up a bit, but I think to respond to your point, certainly this is listed as a qualification, so if students didn't meet this qualification, if it wasn't clear in the application that they were seeking new career paths or retraining to reenter the job market, that you would be fair to not consider them. It would just be you'd have to screen that based on what they put in the application and not based on their age or their enrollment status. Sorry, Carrie?
I feel fairly comfortable with the fact that we do have a D and an E in the qualification, that because we're doing the screening for the applicants, I acknowledge that we probably will receive more applications after this change than we are getting now, but it will still be the job of the group, the selection committee, to determine whether or not the student who has applied is trying to go into a new career path or retrain, or is even in need. So as long as we still retain the selection capability, I think we're covered,
mm-hmm.
even with the change, the removing of F.
I think your point on need is really good, too, because I think item D was the primary consideration is financial need, which I think that someone who was, for example, a single parent could make that a compelling piece of their statement of financial need.
And, of course, it would be the committee would see that as well, you know, and they would be evaluating all the applicants based on the degree to which they meet these two criteria, these specific two criteria. And to also comment on Leslie, a younger student who, one, doesn't really have a career yet, they're still figuring out that career path. They might apply, but the selection committee could really say they're not looking at a new career path because they don't have an existing career path,
mm-hmm.
that they're changing on. It would be really clear for the committee to look at somebody who's, you know, was a teacher and now is maybe trying to become, you know,
surgeon.
Something
yeah.
else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know we have several other items on our agenda today. Are there any final comments before we move to a vote? And there was a comment from Chris that the Regents and Foundation policy needs to change, not the endowment. And from Stacy that D and E can fulfill the intent of the scholarship.
I would say in response to Chris and also back to Jesse's point as well, I think that no matter what the result of the vote is, I think it's important for us to make clear on behalf of staff council that that this caused anxiety amongst our group and that it would certainly be our preference that whatever the policy is, that it doesn't restrict scholarships like this one, that this is something that we consider a problem.
Yeah. So would your preference be to do that in the language of the motion or in the transmission memo?
I think in the transmission memo and in things like reports to the Board of Regents and
okay.
public testimony. And
okay. Excellent. All right. So with that, I guess, are there any motions to amend this motion? Okay, hearing none, all in favor of passing the motion as written, as attached?
Aye.
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 Okay. And thanks, Brad. And opposed? Sorry, Andrew, was that an aye as in favor or an aye, I am opposed? Sorry. Okay, thank you. I just wanted to be clear with the timing. Okay. Okay. So I believe the motion passes. Thank you guys for being so thoughtful on this. I do think, despite my earlier comment on this, I do think that this is really important and that the concern for students and students' access and how we can best support students is really important and is really really worth getting right. So I will, how about this, we'll work on getting the motion signed and finalized to transmit to the foundation, but I will also, before sending it, share a draft sort of memo, cover memo to accompany it that will kind of outline our general concern with this policy in general, and that we're concerned that it might ultimately be hampering our ability to aid students in need.
I mean, from my perspective, it's not our job to write Board of Regents policy. I think it's
sometimes,
but it is our job to reflect the problems that we have with the policy. And I think that this is an example of something that we would prefer not to do, but we have to because of the policy.
Right. Yeah, I think that's fair. All right. So moving on, was there any update on mentoring from advocacy? Great. Thank you, Jamie. And for those of you who didn't see, Jamie says advocacy is meeting tomorrow and this item is on the agenda. We should have an update on this item as well as the Staff Volunteer Day resolution after that meeting. Thank you, Jamie. And for new members, too, and people who haven't heard about this over and over, this issue was Staff Council did a survey to look at kind of staff interest in a more formalized mentoring opportunities. And there was a lot of interest, and so it's sort of a, all right, what would this look like? How could we work with HR to accomplish something like this, and what are the sort of concerns or barriers as well? So just on the topic of some more formalized mentoring opportunities for staff. Next up, strategic pathways. As Nate was careful to say in his comments, the phase one outcomes so far are directions, not decisions. When the president presented to the regents last month, most of the non-academic programs were fairly decisions. You know, have UAF will be the procurement hub for the university, will set the policy and so forth, and there will still be people sitting in Anchorage to help with procurement, but it will ultimately be run under UAF procurement. Research administration, similarly, will be run out of UAF, in part because we do 90% of the research in the system. We have sort of the core expertise. And then IT is slightly more controversial potentially, which was centralized IT, including from the departments. So pulling departmental IT staff centrally where that exists. And I think that also requires some further definition because we have units like the GI that have very, very specific and specialized IT type functions for research computing, for example, that are not really traditional IT, but the staff are classified as IT. So there should be sort of some, certainly many steps to be worked through there. But on the academic and on athletics, there was not actually sort of formal decisions of we will have one dean. It was explore having the one dean for School of Education. That's the one we want to hear more about. That's the one we're most interested in. Come back at our next one and give us more information. So there are some, Chris, what information? Sorry. Well, there's not a lot out there yet. There's the phase one report that's posted on the Strategic Pathways website that kind of outlines briefly that option. And then there's the attached attachment four here is an email that everyone should have received from President Johnson on September 27th that outlined their initial initial directions. So, for example, in information technology, the board supported the recommendation to centralize most IT employees currently working in departments into a central hub on each of the university campuses and to dramatically increase coordination and support for an IT governance structure that will improve our prioritization and funding of IT projects. So there's not a lot right now. I think the next phase is really what they're in the drafting part, that we should see more information in advance of the next board meeting about specifics and what that might look like. And then the phase two teams and timelines are also posted online and were announced. And I'd say, well, Nate's not here right now, but if you're take a look ahead because you can see what the phase three teams will be. I know Nate had a really quick turnaround for getting names to the administration for the phase two teams, but if you're interested in any of the phase three teams, I'd just be proactive in expressing that to him in advance, so that if the process is the same, he's got those ready. So those teams, the phase two teams, should be concluding their meetings in December and sort of their initial presentations. So the next board meeting after that would be February, unless the board takes it up in their retreat in January, but in a February meeting. And it would probably be similar. That's when the board will first kind of hear about this from the president in a presentation-type format, and then they would make their decisions on those items at the next meeting. And then the final group, phase three, the teams will be meeting and working in the spring, and then it would probably be the following fall by the time the board makes any decisions on the outcomes there. But by the end of the spring semester, all the review teams should be concluded for strategic pathways, period. The reviews should all be done, and then they'll be managing the outcomes. So any questions on strategic pathways at this point? And also just a reminder that there is, on that UA Strategic Pathways website, opportunities to provide comment and feedback on any of the recommendations from Phase 1 and also on the general concepts for Phase 2. So I believe the president received over 4,000 comments for the Phase 1 pieces, I'd say mostly. Public comments on athletics were certainly the majority. And speaking on athletics, the board did say their intent was not to eliminate athletics. So the two main piece tracks being pursued for athletics would either be getting a waiver from the NCAA to have fewer teams at each school. Right now at UAF we have the minimum number of teams. So if we can't cut teams, and hence the budget, without being kicked out of the NCAA, basically.
We actually have less than the minimum, I think. We're exempt from some because we can't have sports like football up here.
Right, yeah. So they're looking at trying to get waivers for UAA and UAF, or potentially consolidating and counting as basically counting our teams together towards the minimum, which neither of those are things that we know necessarily whether the NCAA would let us do. But so that's what the charge is right now, is pursue that with the NCAA and see if we can get one of those options in place. Budget update. I talked a bit earlier about the sort of process. I know I think the intent with the UA budget request this year will be don't cut us further. We'll be asking for basically a stable level of funding. from this year with potentially some capital funding for deferred maintenance, which is just a continued huge need at UAF. We have hundreds of millions of dollars of deferred maintenance needs that are basically facilities that we have to maintain or else they start to degrade quickly. So I think there, I would expect some requests there. And then the sort of initial guidance from the governor's office was, and feel free to duck out if you need to in the meantime. Okay, Chancellor Thomas.
Thank you. I think this mic's working. I can hear it. I've got just a few comments today, and we'll be happy to take a couple of questions if time allows. So I heard some discussion about the FY18 budget conversation and where we might be on that. I'll provide a little bit of information on that earlier in the State of the University, but I'll just hit kind of the high points right now. We've got two sources of budget information at the moment. One is U.S. Statewide has submitted a budget to the Board of Regents. The Board will vote on that at their November meeting on the 9th and 10th. And that budget shows two elements. I'll remind you that we received $325 million in state general funding this year. They're asking for $335, so a $10 million increase, so that's the request. In addition, the president has asked for a 10% tuition increase. Each percentage of tuition increase is also about $1 million per percentage, and so that's $10 million across the system. And so effectively, between those two, the university system as a whole would have about $20 million additional if that is approved by both the governor and the legislature. So that's the request that's submitted. Now, the board has not passed that yet. The board can make adjustments to that at their November meeting, and so that's a piece of information. The second piece of information is the governor's guidance, and the governor, very early guidance came to us at the end of August, just to give you some sense, and of course it's subject to significant change because the budget, the governor provides a budget proposal in December before the legislature meets. So, that's subject to revision during that time period. But his initial guidance was to the university a 5 to 10% reduction. Those are the two pieces of information that we have. So what about the UAF budget planning process? So we will wait until after the November meeting to make sure that we're on the same page as the board, because if the board makes changes to what was submitted by Statewide, we want to be able to respond to that. We're also waiting from Statewide on estimates with regard to the benefits rate. Initial conversations on that have been that the benefit rate would be relatively flat, but they continue to do work on that. And so, they're telling us by the time the board meets, they should have that figure well in hand. We also will see what the election, what the results of the election were. That will influence our strategy as well. So those three elements are leading us to a point where we're going to start that budget planning process after that November meeting. That's where we're at right now. All right, so perhaps I'll pause there for a moment to see if there are other questions. I certainly agree with the comment about the uncertainty. This year is a year of uncertainty between strategic pathways and further budget reductions. This is a big year. Part of the reason I'm back, many of you have heard me say that. And the uncertainty is contributing to a lot of different areas. Athletics, certainly, is a key one right now. But it's across the board. All employees, faculty, staff, administrators, everybody is impacted by this. Students are impacted by this uncertainty. So I certainly get all of that. So I'll take any questions on the budget process. Okay. Just want to hit a couple of other things. There is, you have opportunities for public testimony with the Board of Regents October 31st. Yes, Halloween. And it's between 4 to 6, and it's audio-based, just to remind you. That's sort of ideal trick-or-treating time. so it's unfortunate in that regard. October 31st, 4 to 6 is the opportunity there. There's also a Board of Regents reception. That happens Thursday, November 10th. That's the first evening of the board meeting. My understanding is that's currently scheduled for the Globe Room up in Geophysical. And so you have an opportunity to come and share your opinions and talk with individual board members at that. Feel free to do that, of course. One thing I can't emphasize enough this year is to get out and vote in the elections, because that, you know, the people that we elect will have a significant impact on our budget. So keep that in mind. At the September 22nd State of the University address, I said that we would have a forum soon, and I spoke specifically about enrollment and retention strategies that we might take. I'm going to try to broaden that a little bit to revenue generating more generally, because one of the ways to deal with reductions is to generate additional revenue, and we do have some ideas for strategy that we want to get feedback from all of you for. So that's tentatively scheduled for November 1st. That hasn't been announced yet. We're still working out that date, but I wanted to give you some idea of what the timing of that will likely be. And then I've had a couple of staff members raise with me the proposal on the volunteer day business, and I want to let this group know I'm happy to have the cabinet review that proposal and input from you all. So I'm happy to reconsider and re-listen to that element. And with that, I'll pause and I'll take any questions that you have.
How about online? Do we have any questions for the Chancellor or comments?
Well, I have a comment for you that goes back to the uncertainty that we're talking about. We lost one of our really good staff council members last year because of that. And just to let you know that when he left for a university in Reno. And having spoken to him since he's been there, his remarks are that it's so good to go somewhere where you feel wanted and not like they're trying to find a way to get rid of you. That was his comment.
So I hope you know that I certainly value all of you. You're still here. Thank you for that. We need you to, of course, stay and contribute in the ways that you all do, and they're all somewhat different. Staff often takes the brunt of reductions. I'm certainly aware of that. And part of that is, you know, we have, when we reduce academic programs, we have a requirement, an institutional accreditation requirement, to teach those out. And that often takes 6 or 7 years, so it's a much slower process to elect academic programs than it is, of course, to reduce staff positions. So I certainly get that. Don't envy you the situation, of course. My work this year will be primarily trying to keep us at the budget that we're at and not to reduce further. So that's, and if we can get a small bump, like an additional $10 million, that would be great. Those are the elements that I'm arguing. Statement that I continuously make is any further reductions become increasingly difficult and will be more significant in scope.
Yeah. Well, we as staff also understand that the biggest expense is personnel. I mean, you gain a lot more savings cutting personnel than anything else. So we understand that. But like you said, we're still here. But so many people I know that I've heard them talk about and hear, even in this room, how much more workload they have because of staff cuts and to the point where they feel like they're doing two or three jobs, and that's it.
Thank you. I have certainly heard that.
Okay. Maybe just to echo Jesse as well, sometimes as well we are aware that there's crises in morale, and sometimes it's worse than others, but it's often really difficult to know how to handle that because there's not a whole lot we can do. And so maybe personally I would encourage you to keep morale opportunities in mind as you go forward and make decisions and things things that you can, that you personally as our leader can do to address the morale issue, I'm sure would go a long way.
Part of that, of course, is remaining transparent, coming and having these conversations, listening, you know, acknowledging the pain that's being felt to some degree, right? So, but yeah, morale opportunities, thank you for that input.
Matthew, did you?
So, this is just an observation of kind of the way we are going about paying for things. You know, we had to take out bonds to pay for the rest of the engineering building. And I think, I don't know if it was you or President Johnson that mentioned just like relatively how low our tuition is and whether or not, like, kind of financially for the university is taking on this debt or anything like that. I guess I kind of foresee it being problematic, but I guess how do you view it?
So first, a point of clarity. UAF is not getting, not having to deal with the debt service on engineering statewide has accepted a significant role in that, which relieves UAF of some of the debt. And the system as a whole still has to cover it, but that is now effectively shared, if you will, through that process. So the debt service piece was part of the reallocation that the president made this year, just so that you're aware of that, which is good news for UAF, still a struggle for the system, all right? So backing up to, you know, my view of this, was a very bad precedent that the legislature didn't fully fund that building and that the university had the bond to make it up. We have been willing to do that for buildings that would pay for themselves through research grants, et cetera. And that has worked well for us. Let me make that clear. But for a facility that has a primary instructional element to it, that's a new game for us. We felt like we had to do it because we didn't see legislative support coming for it. We made multiple attempts. And, of course, we want and need that facility to fulfill our mission within engineering in particular. So a bad precedent, but, you know, pretty much forced into the only decision that we could make. So not without its challenges. Did I answer your question?
It did. I'm just curious, I guess about, I mean, you're saying bad precedent, and which makes me happy because in the future, hopefully, we won't get into that same sinkhole, I guess.
Yeah. Bad precedent. I'm glad it's funded. I'm glad it's getting finished. I'm going to be thrilled it will continue to improve our ability to recruit more engineering students, which is a positive thing for growing enrollment. So, you know, there's some plus side. You're right, we do have some downside to deal with. Go ahead.
Good morning. The forum, the upcoming forum on November 1st, you're going to increase the agenda on that to include revenue-generating ideas, correct? But that's only for UAF, not for statewide. I'm just curious if during that same discussion you could fill us in on the fact that we're a land sea grant institution and there is that revenue that doesn't seem to be utilized at this point and hasn't been utilized for a while. We have land that we can, as a system, we can sell land to generate revenues.
We do that.
I was under the impression that we hadn't done that for 5 years or so, release land to pay to bring revenue into the budget.
I think that might be a good one to address. I guess I'm somewhat more familiar with the land sales process at the university, but it is something certainly that we see come up a lot in public discussion. Is always that question of, well, why don't you sell your land? Why don't you sell your land? So it might be worth addressing as a point, just where we're at with that, and potentially as a related topic. I know there's been some work with the delegation to try to get us a more substantial actual land grant, because we received the smallest land grant in 50 states or in any land grant state, and where there might be opportunity to increase that piece. Any other questions for the chancellor? Sure.
Low tuition enrollment, or low enrollment in other increases and law school programs. I'm not sure if I'm correct on that, but I guess my question is, how do you plan on reconciling getting more students to come with the higher cost? Because I know, for instance, you know, we do charge less than our based on the West Coast, but if the cost of living here is 50% higher than it is in the University of Arizona, and the cost of tuition is the same,
So just a point of clarity, bachelor's degree tuition is about 19% lower than the Western states average, all right? So it's bachelor's degrees. So that's just in-state tuition. Out-of-state tuition, we're also significantly lower. Right? So if you go to out-of-state tuition at Arizona State, significantly different. Right? So there's a number of elements at play. And similarly, the residence hall costs are distinctly different. Right? So there's a lot of different elements that come into play, whether a student would come here or go elsewhere. Right? So we do have challenges both on the graduate tuition and on certificate and applied associate tuition. Certificate and applied associate tuition is higher at UAF and UA system as a whole than it is in other states, including the Western states. And so there's concern about raising tuition there. I've expressed those to UA statewide in this conversation about tuition. Again, haven't passed the board yet, so it's still subject to conversation. So one point of interest that you might find curious, we have super tuition, right, that tuition surcharge for both engineering and school of management at this point. After those were implemented, we had enrollment growth in both of those areas, all right? So raising tuition doesn't necessarily mean fewer students, right? And we have evidence based on those two units for that reason. Now, will the same hold true for certificate and applied associates? Hard to say. We have, that's the largest area of enrollment decrease that we observed this last year was in those areas. And so have we surpassed the point of price elasticity there? Unclear. Certainly has potential. One of the areas that we want to work on in this strategy is that area is one of several that needs additional scholarship money. They don't have much scholarship money. And so offsetting some of these tuition elements with additional scholarship money, perhaps through public-private partnerships, where private industry puts in some, we put in some, you get the idea. To leverage there would have some advantage, so that's being explored. But there are ways to deal with that by area that could help make a difference, and that's part of this enrollment and both recruitment and retention discussion that we want to have. Okay? So it's a broader conversation.
And I do believe, Chancellor, correct me if I'm wrong, but that'll be a big piece of your forum, is the enrollment and retention strategy as well.
It will be. That's, you know, there certainly are other opportunities. We have a good start to a plan there, but we need feedback from a broad, you know, UAF constituency on it. You know, what are good reality checks, what are not? Where are there new programs? So I heard one that sounded very exciting to me the other day. You know, there's a lot more flesh out that needs to be done, but drone cinematography. Wow. Who would have guessed as a certificate or applied associate program? We already have the licensing for drones. We have a lot of expertise both on the film side and on the drone operation side. Wow, interesting combo, right? So are there opportunities like that would draw in new students? That, you know, those are the kinds of elements that we're looking at. There are other examples. That's just the most recent one that I've heard.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, and we appreciate you coming.
Thank you for your engagement. Thank you for your service.
Okay, so we are running a bit behind. If we could try for a 5-minute break right now, that would be great. And just come back as quickly as you can. Thank you. Okay, I think we'll go ahead and start reconvening. Yeah. So we can knock out the rest of this agenda. So going back to our unfinished business. I know Jamie mentioned earlier that advocacy would be discussing the volunteer day proposal at the meeting tomorrow. So if we want to just keep this pending until the next meeting, but that's probably a good opportunity if there are people who are not on the advocacy committee who are really interested in this topic, just to remember that all committee meetings are open as well, and you could feel free to attend. And that the time and everything should be listed on the staff council website. I think probably Jamie, correct me if I'm wrong, but employee giving initiative is a little bit related to that, and probably also. Yeah. All right, great. So furlough and leave accrual, we talked a little bit about that with HR this morning. Basically, that they did put in this process to make sure that salaried and hourly staff were being treated similarly under the furlough. Brad, I know you had some concerns about how the policy was worded to ensure that this is applied fairly in any future years. Is that something maybe that you want to take to staff affairs, or do you want to do a very brief discussion now? Okay. Okay, so yeah, staff affairs is interested. I think the concern is that the way the furlough policy is written, it seems to say you won't be accruing leave while you're on furlough, but your benefits won't change. And so in practice, the way the leave code was set up and the leave process was set up, what was happening this year is if you're salaried, we took a base pay reduction in exchange for, 5 days. So basically, I'm salaried and furloughed. My base pay went down by the equivalent of 5 days, but spread out through every paycheck, and then I just have to take those 5 days throughout the year. For hourly employees, they're basically getting a leave without pay type code, as Margo described. So my leave accrual as a salaried employee in the system had no changes to it, and then they had to do this funky preloading piece to get hourly employees the same treatment. But it seems to, in the policy, imply that this is not necessarily always going to be the case and was maybe just a workaround this year. So right now there's three departments at UAS that are
that are furloughed. It's Environmental Health, Safety, and Risk Management, Office of Management and Budget, and the Library. And we're the only ones, other than leadership furloughs in some places, we're the only staff being furloughed this year throughout the UA system. So this is probably a good opportunity to have some lessons learned and some feedback so that if it is used in future years, it can be maybe a smoother process as well. So yeah, if staff affairs wants to take that up, that would be great. Single accreditation at the Regents Forum, or the Regents last meeting, the president advised that single accreditation not be pursued at this time. That the outcomes of Chancellor Thomas's report were pretty clear that it wasn't worth it right now and wouldn't really get us where we needed to go. It would more be a distraction. However, he did leave it on the table, and the Regents left it on the table as something to consider further if, for example, Strategic Pathways does not have the results that he intends. So back to that uncertainty Jesse mentioned, it does extend that uncertainty as well in the single accreditation area because it's just off the table for now, but who knows if they'll take it up again in a year, and so we also don't know right now what that means in terms of a permanent chancellor for UAF or any of those issues. So I expect that there'll be a little while before we hear any more on that direction-wise. But it might be a good question at our next meeting is if there have been any indications of, I think Dana Thomas is in for a year, but if there's been any discussion of what the next step might be chancellor-wise. Okay. And we have two committees that we need representation. Brad is stepping down from the Master Planning Committee after lots of excellent service, so that's probably a very intriguing one. And I know Kara is on it through her day job, basically. So Brad and Kara might be good people to ask if you're interested, but that could be a very interesting committee to be on and would be good to have a seat. So if you know you're interested, just email me or Nicole or Nate and say, appoint me. And if you have questions first, Kara and Brad would be good people to talk to about it. And you do have to submit a monthly report to staff council. So the easiest way to do that is probably take whatever the agenda was, scribble some notes on it, and send it in. It doesn't have to be like a two-page report that you draft from scratch, where we could more just let people know what happened and what items were discussed. And then membership and rules, we still need a committee chair or co-chairs. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Matthew, but I think you had mentioned the committee was really hopeful that someone from outside the committee would step up as chair just because you guys are already feeling very overtaxed.
Yeah. Correct.
So this is a great leadership opportunity as well. Trish has done just an amazing job setting things up in a really great way, and it's a very dedicated and productive group. I'd say serving as a committee chair is not always that much more effort than serving on a committee in terms of outside time commitments, and it's a good way to start getting kind of a more leadership involvement and then involvement with executive board and so forth. So if you're at all curious or willing to try, you can also try it and then decide after a couple months, no, I really don't have time for this, but if someone would just try it right now, that would be great. So same deal, you can volunteer right now or just email. Okay. All right.
Who can someone talk to that's interested in it to find out what it entailed?
For membership and rules, I would say Trish would probably still be a good person to talk to if Trish is willing. And then if you're on the Membership and Rules Committee, just raise your hand. So Matthew would also be a good person to talk to about the committee itself and maybe what are some of
some kind of active topics are, and Bradley Crick as well.
5324.
Yes, yes. There's Trisha's phone number, and she will also give you a copy of Robert's Rules of Order. All right. So, staff achievements and highlights. I'd say this is especially to the credit of the Elections Committee and Nicole, hugely, but also to all our representatives. We have 77 active nominations for the election this fall, which is shattering all records. It's huge. I think part of that is because there's so much going on right now that people want to be involved in, but also knowing that people are feeling a lot more time pressures in their day job. I think it's in part due to the leadership that you guys have demonstrated, that people feel that that would be a valuable use of their time, that they would be willing and interested to participate. So just thank you all very much, and I'm glad to see many familiar names on the nomination list as well for people continuing. So, yeah, just a huge thank you there. And then I also wanted to say, I believe Andrew Gray, who's serving as a proxy for Amanda Wall today, was elected to the Borough Assembly. So congratulations, Andrew, and I think that's a pretty huge accomplishment as well from a UAF staff person.
Terrific.
Did anyone else have any staff achievements and highlights to share? All right. Sorry, trying to fly through some of these. As Colby mentioned, ASUAF is having a legislative candidate forum October 13th, 6 to 8 p.m. in Scheibel Auditorium. We will contact Kari and ask for guidance on Colby's comment about participation from staff. I don't know if that means we're not supposed to be actively asking questions or if it just means we're not supposed to be hosting it directly and participating that way.
I have a little information to clarify. In our pre-staff meeting on Friday, Kari brought this up, and I think that she was just very careful to clarify that initially there were some suggestions or ideas about governance groups partnering with ASUAF to actually put this candidate forum on, and general counsel, I think it was advising against that, against using any resources to actually prepare questions or secure catering or anything like that. So we can't do that, but we can definitely help in terms of if they need extra help to like run microphones or to like set up or something like that. I think that that's fine if we want to do that, and we definitely should feel encouraged to attend as members of the public and as UAF employees. I think that it's fine to be there. Asking questions on our own behalf is fine. I think just the general rules about using university resources, including our time, to advocate on behalf of any political position or any candidate is it's just not allowed.
Right. So, conveniently, this is outside normal business hours. Right. So your time is, unless you work a off schedule, your time is your own from 6 to 8 p.m. So you should be able to participate fully as a member of the public in this forum. Nonpartisan discussion is allowed.
I think that the sort of specific point is just that if there's any if the waters get muddied at all in terms of messaging from either of the candidates or on the part of the forum, I think that that's where they want to steer clear of having us as university representatives reflect either candidate in a specific way.
All right. The next point there, the RISE board, which is the board that governs the student sustainability fee, basically, and uses that for projects, has changed their governance agreement. And as it was explained to me, this was because with the budget cuts this year, one of the pieces that was cut was the Chancellor's matching funds for sustainability, which traditionally had paid, basically funded the Office of Sustainability, which then partnered with the students and the RISE Board. And so they're basically changing bits of the RISE Board so that the RISE Board and the Office of Sustainability can continue to exist, but through ASUAF, particularly using that student sustainability fee. And so they went through and adjusted the governance agreement, which impacts us in that traditionally we have we had a staff appointment to the RISE Board. That staff council would appoint someone to serve on that. And since this is now pretty much entirely funded by the students, they said, well, we'd like to select someone, but just have them looped in with staff council. And they plan to continue having Ian Olson, who was our appointment anyway. And they did the same with the faculty member as well. And some of the students. And so when this came to me, I think ASUAS and Faculty Senate had already signed off on it as well. And it's, I did stress that we would appreciate that their bylaws include requiring a report to us just so to keep us in the loop. But this was also something that was they said they want the student or the staff perspective, but it's administering student funds. So there was this sort of sense of, well, it's our thing. We can probably appoint our own choice to it. So anyway, just a point of order that has changed slightly, and that instead of us doing a formal appointment, they'll select someone and keep us informed. And then committee reports. And Brandy is out today, is that correct?
I don't have a message.
So the elections committee hasn't been meeting formally as a committee, but has been working through the challenges of this election. And I just want to give a huge kudos to Nicole for kind of working with an election system that is not super intuitive and that was sort of handed off last minute without a lot of technical support.
I'd like to thank Brandy. I know she's not here, but for everything that she's done to help move things along.
So yeah, it's been a heroic effort this year by Elections Committee, sort of outside the norm. And I also thank you to our new members of the Election Committee for stepping up and participating as well. So the deadline to accept nominations was last Friday. And so voting will open. Voting will open sometime soon, and there will be an email. Okay. Membership and rules didn't meet. Need the chair. Someone volunteer, please, and let us know. Rural affairs. I saw you attached a committee report, Chris. Do you have anything to add to that? Awesome. Thank you. And thanks also to, I think we have one or two new members on that committee, so that's great. And staff affairs.
We did not meet. Our next committee meeting is Friday the 21st, and we'll be keeping with our previous time slot, which is 10 o'clock on the third Friday of every month.
Great. And then advocacy, as Jamie mentioned, will be meeting tomorrow. And the time and place are posted online, I believe, where you can contact Jamie. Okay, thank you. And then I know Leslie mentioned before we began that there was some information to share from the Employee Engagement Subcommittee. There wasn't a report attached, but... Oh, and yes, thank you, Tara, for co-chairing. Great. Thank you, Leslie. Okay. Any other committee reports that anyone would like to raise or add? I didn't have anything in my notes. So with that, we could turn the recording. Well, let's first, if there are any announcements that anyone would like made on the record, this is the last chance. Okay, so if we could turn the recording off.